Hello, and welcome to Onward, the Fundrise podcast, where you can usually find out more about what's happening at Fundrise, and where typically you'll hear in-depth conversations about the big trends affecting the U.S. and global economies. But not on this episode. I believe my guest today has discovered the fundamental nature of the universe, and nobody noticed. So I wanted to share it with you. We'll return with our regular programming later this month. My name is Ben Miller. I am CEO and co-founder of Fundrise. My guest today is Amanda Gefter, a writer in fundamental physics, cosmology, cognitive science, and philosophy, and the author of the book, Trespassing on Einstein's Lawn. Before we get started, I want to remind you that this podcast is not an investment advice. It is intended for quantum informational purposes only. So Amanda Gefter, welcome to Onward.
Thank you for having me.
So this is a little bit far afield from our normal topic, but I feel you've revealed the fundamental nature of the universe in your book.
I tried.
I wanted to share it with more people. I read it, and then I thought, wow, how come more people aren't in the streets talking about what you said and what's happening in science? It's just absolutely incredible.
Thank you. I wonder the same thing.
Okay, well, that's why we're doing this. I wanted to give you a megaphone. But let me just, before we get into it, because this is a very complex topic, and I will only understand some small part of it, is I wanted to voice why I find it so exciting, because it helps people frame what you're going to talk about. This is how I articulate it. You may have some edits to it. So everybody's heard of the Big Bang, and you, in your book, seek to, and I think, like, arguably answer some of the deepest questions of life, which are, one, what came before the Big Bang? So where did the universe come from? And two, what is the universe?
Yeah.
Yeah. And you actually successfully did it, which is what's so insane.
Thank you. I mean, I was just drawing from all the latest physics, and I can't take credit for any of that, but I think my dad, I talk about my dad in the book, and I think he did have some amazing Zen insights into the nature of reality. But yeah, we were trying to synthesize what's going on in physics.
Yeah, you said the magic word, synthesize. Yeah, you brought it together, you integrated it in a way that I feel everybody's focused on the parts and you were focused on the whole.
Yeah, I mean, I think we started with these big questions. So I think a lot of people that start in physics, they're starting with, if you're going through an academic track in physics, you're starting with these very specific things. And maybe once in a while you stop and think about the big picture, or you take a philosophy class that allows you to do that. But in general, you're just head down, focused on problems. And we had this advantage of coming in and starting with just the big questions that you're talking about. And so since that was always front of mind, I feel we were able to draw together a lot of things that maybe people who are more professional at physics just don't even have a chance to stop and think about.
Yeah. So here's how I want to break down this conversation. So first, I thought it'd be useful if you could restate the thesis from your book for our listeners.
So this whole thing started, the book is this weird hybrid of a physics book and a memoir. And so it started when I was a teenager and I was out to dinner at a Chinese restaurant with my dad, and he leans over and asks me, how would you define nothing? Which was not that weird of a question for my dad to ask at dinner. That's totally his personality. But I was just this rebellious teenager and I was not interested in science. But I don't know, something about this question caught my imagination. We ended up having this whole conversation about nothing, which led to this insane 17-year journey trying to understand the nature of reality. But basically, the idea that my dad had was that nothingness is always defined in terms of what it isn't, and he wanted to define it in terms of what it is. And so he had this idea that if you had an infinite, unbounded state of complete sameness, so total homogeneous state, which he started calling the H state, that would be nothing. That would be indistinguishable from nothing. And even though that's just a silly trick in a way, it's actually useful because It's not an absence. And so if you're asking this question, how do you get something from nothing? How does the universe begin? If you're starting with just an absence, how do you ever get anything? But if you're starting with a pattern, or a configuration of everything where you just have it all in this sameness state, it becomes more thinkable that you might be able to get a universe for nothing. And so that was the philosophical idea that we were starting with. And then I guess the other aspect of the thesis was that we realized that when you ask this question of what is ultimately real, it's a vague philosophical question, but physicists have a very rigorous way of defining that, which is to say something is real if it's invariant, which means something is real if we would all see it, or if you take all these different reference frames. So in physics, you can do this in very abstract ways, but you can imagine almost if I see a pink elephant and I say, do you see that pink elephant too? And you're like, what are you talking about? Then, oh, I'm hallucinating. That's not real. Because we have this intuitive idea that we should all agree on reality on some level. And so that pervades physics in a really deep way where you can make these mathematical transformations in these very abstract spaces. And you can see if certain aspects of the physical world stay there or disappear or change. And so we started looking at, I'm probably jumping ahead here, but we started looking at like, what are all these ingredients of reality and trying to see, can you get back to nothing, basically? So we start with nothing. We tried to get back to nothing and to see if you could have a universe that comes from nothing.
So your hypothesis is that the universe is nothing and you use that as a mechanism to gather information from across physics and also across philosophy.
Yeah.
So before we get to the solutions of the work you did to try to figure that out, I always say I like to start with the problem, because if you understand the problem, you're much more likely to get to the right solution. So I had some ways I thought about the way you had framed the problem, but do you want to try to state the problem? Or I could even try to state it for you because maybe you don't know where I'm going here.
Yeah. I'll let you state it for me.
Okay. Let me give you the two problems I feel like I gathered from your book, because they're distinct, but I perceive them as distinct. So the problem number one is the one that John Archibald Wheeler keeps saying, which is how come quantum physics?
Yes.
From a broader audience, I say, why such strange behavior? Why is quantum physics so weird?
Yeah.
And there's a quote here from Richard Feynman, which is, quote, quantum mechanics describes nature as absurd from the point of view of common sense, yet it fully agrees with experiment, end quote. One way to frame the problem you're trying to figure out is, why is quantum physics so weird? Why quantum physics?
Yeah, I love the way Wheeler phrases that. Yeah, he says, why the quantum? Exactly. It's why should the universe operate according to these rules? I mean, you could ask that even if the rules were common sense, you would still want to know, well, why those rules? Physicists have this feeling, almost like an emotional feeling, that the universe should just be some particular way because there's no other way it could be. And so they want to get to that inevitability. So you could ask that no matter what, but then quantum mechanics adds this extra layer where not only why is it these laws of physics, but why are they so bizarre? And why does it not seem to gel with how we just experience the world in our everyday lives?
So because most people haven't probably studied quantum mechanics, I thought it would be interesting just to share a few examples of how strange it is. Because when people say it's strange, I mean, it is bonkers strange.
Yeah, it's absolutely bonkers. It's one of those things where it's fun to talk to physicists about, because even physicists who deal with this every single day, it's their workday life, they still feel like it's bonkers. It doesn't matter how well you know it, it's still bonkers. So the double slit experiment is the really classic. If anyone listening doesn't know about this, they should definitely watch some YouTube videos where you can actually see the whole experiment be done, because it's just makes you want to tear your hair out, but in the best possible way. And I don't know if I need to explain the whole thing, but basically you can have these situations where you have a particle, let's say like an electron or something, that should only be able to be in one place at a time. And you end up getting these experimental results that can only be explained if the electron was in multiple places at the same time. I mean, there's other ways of talking about this. The language gets really, really tricky because it depends how you interpret all this stuff. And you could say the electron isn't anywhere. So one way, Feynman would be someone who would say the electron, if it's traveling from point A to point B, when we're not looking, it takes every possible path. Niels Bohr, someone might say, well, when we're not looking, it just doesn't even have a path. It doesn't have a location. You can't even, it's not something you can talk about. Either way, it's completely bizarre because why should it matter whether we're looking or not? You would think the whole idea of classical physics was the world is this clockwork machine and it just churns along and it makes absolutely no difference who's observing, what it means to observe. It just is some particular way. And the lesson of quantum mechanics is it's not just some particular way. There's just no consistent way. And people have tried literally everything. And there's just no consistent way to make any kind of claim. The electron is here. The electron is there. I might see it one way. You might see it another way. And there's no fact of the matter.
Yeah, it's so strange that if you're coming to this not having a sense of the strangeness, it's hard for us to communicate that. I mean, two examples of that you touched on were basically the delayed choice experiment.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Which is one that basically, from one perspective, blows up the idea of causality.
Yeah.
Or even the idea of a linear sense of time. So, like you just said, that where or what a particle is up for debate. And then also, in what order things happen in the universe. Things that we think of as common sense break down in quantum mechanics. That's what we mean by it's so strange.
Yeah, the delayed choice is by far the craziest one. And that was Wheeler that came up with that. And you can talk about not just where the electron is in the lab right next to you, but what path did this electron take 10 billion years ago before any of us were here? And somehow my measurement in the here and now is determining that in some way that seems to go against all of our intuitions.
When you see a photon coming from a star a billion light years away, how you saw it at that moment affected the path it took from that star a billion light years away to now.
Yeah. Yeah. It's crazy.
Yeah. So, okay. So I think we're getting at some of the parts of the nature of the universe that are so unintuitive. It's interesting why you and your father started wondering, is there a way to make this make sense from the top down, from a big picture way, rather than from the bottom up? Because the bottom up, which is what quantum mechanics is, it doesn't make sense. And it hasn't made sense for 100 years. And that's just, I think physics has been like, yeah, that's just the way it is.
Yeah.
And you actually had the audacity to try to go into that. So, okay, so you basically attacked this, I think, two ways. You attacked it basically by examining it from a sort of a formal logic point of view. And then you attacked it systematically, looking at all the building blocks of the universe and asking the questions, which one of these are real objectively? I thought maybe we'd do the logic part first, because in some ways that's, even though it's also a little bit mind-bending, you can understand logic in a way that's, I can't understand quantum mechanics.
Yeah.
Let me just try to tee you up here.
Please.
Okay, you start with a premise in the book, which is, I love this because you start at such basic principles. You start with the premise of even an idea of a universe, because it presumes a thing.
Yeah.
And you basically get into this logical challenge of how would you measure a universe if you're inside the universe? That's the logical puzzle that you start to try to unfold in the book.
Yeah, this is a fascinating issue that I still think about all the time. If you think of the universe as an object, which I think in the end we can't really do, but if you try to think of it as a thing, it's the only thing that only has an inside and not an outside, which is just a very weird Mobius strip-ish type of paradoxical, impossible object. I think I refer to it in the book as a one-sided coin. That's the definition of the universe, is you can't be outside the universe. It's everything there is. And this introduces a ton of really deep conceptual issues in physics, even though it seems like this trivial thing, because when you make a measurement, you're always outside the thing that you're measuring. And since you can't do that, so it has a really simple example where this comes in is, if you want to talk about the energy of the universe or the mass of the universe by E equals MC squared, those are the same thing. Normally, the only way to give a real, an operational definition of something's energy or mass is to throw it in orbit around another planet or put it on a scale, or you have to have it interact with something else and see how it affects that thing. And then that's how you define its mass. And so with the universe as a whole, you can't do that. There's just no place to get that kind of leverage. And then, for instance, in Einstein's theory of general relativity, which is the theory we would use to describe the whole universe, there's no way to say within the framework of that theory what the energy of the universe is. And so you would think that's a really fundamental thing. What's the mass of the universe? What's the energy of the universe? And there's no way to answer that. And then that's just a simple example, but then it gets really profound when in quantum mechanics, which is really our best theory of how the world works, you have to have an observer. We were just saying, if you don't have an observer, and we can get into how you even define what an observer is, but just assume it's a measuring device or something. If you don't have an observer, you can't even say the electron has a particular position or momentum or takes a particular path. And you can't say anything. There's no fact of the matter until you define an observer. But if you can't have an observer of the universe, then there's no fact of the matter about the universe. And now you're in this really weird situation that people deal with. And this is a field called quantum cosmology. So it's using quantum mechanics, which we usually think of for very small things, particles and stuff. But the theory itself doesn't say, at this size, quantum mechanics stops. I mean, it's quantum mechanics all the way up. It's just easier to see the effects when you're talking about really little things. So the whole universe at some level has to obey the laws of quantum mechanics. And then there's no way to apply them consistently when you can't get outside the universe. So you have these really weird paradoxes. And the whole idea of physics since Newton is that there should be some way to talk about the whole thing. There should be universal laws. There should be almost a God's eye view, third person perspective, where you can just, even if, okay, you could say, obviously we can't literally stand outside the universe and look at it, but we can use math to act as if we can do that. So you can just take that perspective mathematically, and we can just brush aside the fact that obviously no one's actually going to do that. But the thing that I found out in the course of this whole journey that was so mind-blowing was you can't even do it mathematically. You end up violating laws of physics left and right when you try to take that God's eye view. And so it's the laws of physics themselves are constructed in such a way that don't allow you to take that perspective, which implies that reality is constructed in such a way that doesn't allow you to take that perspective. And then all the implications that that has.
Okay, I'm loving this. But I want to tee you up and talk about the part that I thought of as pure logic, okay, was Gödel's problem of self-reference.
Yeah.
Which is, this sentence is a lie. Maybe walk through that example of logic.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, Wheeler was obsessed with this. What Gödel realizes, there are certain statements you can make logically that you can't assign logicians would call a truth value. You can't say if it's true or false without stepping outside the logical system that you're using. So there are statements, and these statements all have this property of self-reference that you're talking about. And so the idea is, when you have something that is self-referential, it might be, oh man, let me think for one second.
This is the part that is so mind-breaking.
It's been a minute since I thought about how to say this.
Yeah, because I was just reading this over the weekend again. So the statement, I actually do this with my kids. I say to them, okay, this sentence is a lie.
Yeah.
So if the sentence is true, then the sentence is a lie.
If it's true, if it's false, if it's false, it's true.
If the sentence is a lie, then it's not true, which would mean that it's not a lie. And so it's a circular reference, and that's a metaphor for the universe.
That aspect, and then there's also, well, I think these are the same thing. I'm saying this in a different way, but there's statements that are true but can't be confirmed. So
confirmed from the inside or verified from the inside. They're going to be verified from outside.
Yeah. So you always have to step outside the system you're in to then assess the truth or falsity of the thing you're looking at. And so it's just, it's another way of saying the same thing of the observer has to be outside the system. And then when you're talking about the universe as a whole, obviously you can't be outside the system, but the universe is sort of fundamentally self-referential because it contains its observers on the inside. And so I think about this a lot. People in the circles that I am in talk all the time. Nobody else talks about about the conflict between general relativity and quantum mechanics. So these are the two pillars of modern physics, but they're incompatible in certain deep ways, both philosophically and mathematically. And the search to unite them is this search for the theory of everything. And there's all these really technical ways that you can explain what the incompatibility is. But what it really comes down to is just a question of, is the observer on the inside or the outside? And so general relativity is talking about a system that contains its own observers. And what Wheeler was saying is like, any system like that is going to be self-referential, and then you're going to be subject to Gödelian type of paradoxes. Whereas in quantum mechanics, the observer is always on the outside. And then again, the question is, well, how, if you're talking about the whole universe, how do you deal with that?
I just wanted to lay out that logical puzzle.
Yeah.
Before we get into the process you went through in detail. And then, so the way that you summarize it in the book is essentially there's no objective universe, only a subjective universe, just from a pure definitional logic. Because you can't create an objective definition of it from the inside.
Yeah. I mean, the terms get really tricky. There's an interview that Niels Bohr gave the day before he died. It's this amazing interview with Thomas Kuhn. And he has this line where he says something, well, like what the philosophers don't realize, this is the objective description. The way you use terms like objective and subjective is, it's subjective, but not in the sense that we might use the word world. It's just, you can say whatever you want. It's not subjective in that sense, but it's subjective in the sense of there's just not one fact of the matter. But it's almost objectively true that there's not one fact of the matter. So yeah, I'm just throwing that out there in case people hear subjective and think, oh, it means the universe is whatever I want it to be.
Yeah, you define it pretty tightly in the book. And so the definition of objective is that you can measure it. Multiple people can measure it and get the same result.
Yeah.
And so what quantum physics basically has proven is that's impossible.
Yes.
So by subjective, what you mean and what I'm trying to rearticulate is it's based on the observer's point of view.
Exactly.
It's observer dependent.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, so subjective to the observer, not subjective to your opinion.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. So I want to now get into the case you make, because in a way, we're doing what you did in the book, which is you sort of have these lofty aims. And at the end, when you resolved it, I was like, well, I never imagined you would resolve it. How could they possibly have happened? And then I was like, why don't more people tell me about this? So we'll come back to this, but there's another thing that just been blowing my mind, especially when I reread the book for today's interview, was that not only is there no God's eye view now, but there actually can be no God's eye view ever.
Yeah.
Into the future.
Yeah.
We can come back to that, but that's just so, because the future affects the present according to quantum physics.
Yeah. Wheeler has a great quote, which I wish I could think of the exact words, but there's no stranger aspect of quantum mechanics than like the coupling between past, present, and future that it brings about. they're entangled in this way that goes against all of our intuition.
So now let's get to the meat of the book, which is where you go into detail. And so you have this process where you prove out your hypothesis by testing every fundamental thing in the universe. And the question is basically, is it real, objectively real, or is it essentially, you call it the reality test, which is basically, can you find a perspective, a frame of reference in which the thing disappears?
Yeah, exactly.
If you can basically create a test that makes it an illusion or subject to a perspective, a point of reference, then it can't be invariant.
Yes.
And they use the word invariant, which I think is, I just go with real.
Right, right.
And then you list on the back of an IHOP napkin.
Yeah.
And so you hear all the things that you tested: matter, energy, gravity, the speed of light, space-time, electromagnetism, the nuclear forces, charge, dimensions, particles, fields, vacuums, strings, the universe, and the multiverse.
Yes.
And you found, which we'll get into a little bit here, that everyone is subjective, relative, not real.
Yeah. I mean, which is so crazy when you think about it. But yeah, that's right.
So I think the best way to illustrate it with an example.
Sure.
The one I wanted to start with, but I thought we could do a few because it's, I mean, I don't even know what a string
yes.
is. so I'm not going to do that one.
It's fine.
Yeah. So, I mean, I've read about it, but every time I read about it, I'm like, this doesn't make any sense to me. So let's do the speed of light, because I think most people are familiar with Einstein's theory of relativity. And, you know, in a way, like time and space being relative is something that's understood by most people in, you know, society. And so you're taking that idea of relativity and applying it to everything.
Yeah.
Everything's relative. And that's saying something's relative is to say that basically it's not the same from different perspectives,
yeah.
which you're saying would be then it's, under your definition, not invariant. I like the speed of light is beautiful as an example of what you mean.
It's interesting because in a certain way, it's the most controversial example, but it's also not that hard to see in a way. I mean, I'll start by just maybe saying Einstein was the first person to really see this link between invariance and reality. The whole course of physics and the whole philosophy of physics and everything really takes a wild turn when Einstein comes onto the scene. And even though this is pre-quantum mechanics, and it has to do with the speed of light, because in classical physics, Newton's physics, everyone thought light just traveled instantaneously. And what that means is you're in DC and I'm in Boston. Okay, we're looking around, we see different things. In principle, we could always see the same thing. There's nothing you could see that I can't. I could go to where you are and I'll see what you see. There's no limitation to agreement in that sense. And then Einstein comes along and realizes, oh, the speed of light is finite. It takes time for light to travel. And then when you add that to the fact that the universe has not existed eternally, it started 14 billion years ago. So light has only had 14, I mean, it's a long time, but it's only had 14 billion years to travel. And so two observers who are significantly far apart, or even two observers who are in the next room, frankly, but it becomes more noticeable if you're talking about like observers on different galaxies or something, they're going to see very different things because light that might reach one of them has not had enough time to reach the other. And so you suddenly have the situation where not everyone has the same perspective. And now you have to say, well, what looks different in these different perspectives and what looks the same? And by asking that question, Einstein was able to see that these things that we took as absolute bedrock features of reality, namely space and time. Of course, space is the same for everyone. Of course, time is the same for everyone. That was assumed. That would have been crazy to question. And then he's doing this exercise of looking at how things look from different perspectives and realizing, you know what, it's not the same for everyone. So once you have this finite speed of light, not only is it finite, but the speed of light is the same for everyone. So that becomes the invariant. But then by doing that, space and time, so distances, durations, those become relative or observer dependent. And so those are no longer real. And people realize that when he first said that, there was some great quote that Hermann Minkowski, who was a mathematician at the time, said, where now that Einstein has done this, space and time are doomed to be mere shadows. The reality is being sucked out of them. That's not what he said. It was a much more elegant quote. But basically, that space and time can't be real anymore. And then it turns out in relativity, there is something that's still invariant, or there is something that's still real, which is the space-time continuum, which is this four-dimensional combination of space and time. So what I see as space, you could see as time. We can disagree on all those things, but the combo of space and time will always agree. I'm basically just taking Einstein's process and applying it to all these other things. But the speed of light, he would have not wanted to apply that to, because the speed of light being invariant was essential to the entire theory of relativity. So in a certain way, that's ultimate invariant. And so if you can show that that's not invariant, then you have a situation. And so that ends up being the last thing in the book that we looked at, because it just seems so, of course that's invariant. You're hearing, okay, it's the speed of light. Okay, big deal. But if you look at the way the theory is set up, the speed of light is the seam that stitches together space and time. And so it's really critical to the whole architecture of the universe. So if you make that subjective in this way, things get really weird. But the insight that my dad had, and he got it from this physicist, Laurent Nuttall, was that actually there is a reference frame in which the speed of light changes. For anyone moving at speeds less than the speed of light, the speed of light's always the same. But if you're moving at the speed of light, so if you are the light, it has no speed. And one way of thinking about that is from the perspective of a photon, there's no space and no time. A photon experiences what physicists call a singularity, which would be at the origin of the universe or the center of a black hole or something, where space and time become just this one infinite point. And so space and time disappear if you are the light. So in almost every possible perspective, the speed of light is invariant, but the one perspective, which is the perspective of the light itself, it's not invariant.
So let me just read this. I went and Googled, at speed of light, time stops. And I got to a website by the physics department of Texas A&M. And I wrote this quote down because I feel it's the essence of the idea that you're blowing up. And then we'll go to another fundamental thing in the universe.
Okay.
Because we're starting at the end.
Yeah.
But I just, most people are familiar with relativity and the speed of light. So I thought it was an accessible place to begin. So let me just read this to you because I thought it was so perfect. In the limit that its speed approaches the speed of light in vacuum, its space shortens completely down to zero width, and its time slows to a dead stop.
Yeah.
Okay, wait. Let me just read this whole thing. Some people interpret this mathematical limit to mean that light, which obviously moves at the speed of light, experiences no time because time is frozen. But this interpretation is wrong. This limiting behavior simply tells us that there is no valid reference frame at the speed of light. A reference frame that has exactly zero spatial width and exactly zero time elapsing is simply a reference frame that does not exist. If an entity is zero in every way we try to describe it, how can we possibly say that entity exists in any meaningful way? We can't. Space and time simply don't exist at and beyond the speed of light in vacuum. If we pretend that light has a reference frame, then what would happen will only lead to nonsense answers.
Wow, I've never seen that. That's amazing. I mean, it's funny because I haven't actually really seen a lot of physicists even talk about this issue. So it's funny to hear someone say it in that way. I mean, what they're saying is correct, but then the logical jump that they make to, therefore, that's just not a valid reference frame. I mean, it's true in a sense, but that's also saying singularity at the origin of the universe or singularity in a black hole is not a valid reference frame, which you might say. I mean, it depends how you want to talk about this stuff. But it's telling you something really deep about the nature of reality that that's the case. Yeah. I mean, the way I talk about it in the book is a photon sees nothing. I mean that in the positive sense of what I was calling like the H state. Photon sees nothingness, which is, I think, ultimate reality. So you could say, well, if it's experiencing nothing, then it's just not a reference frame. But I think that's a funny way of saying the same thing in a certain sense.
I agree with you. You've persuaded me. And your argument was that the universe is fundamentally nothing and at the same time something. And we can talk about that at the end. But the math of Einstein's general theory of relativity says that essentially time and space shrink to zero. So it's in the math. It's been staring us in the face for 100 years.
Yeah.
And instead of saying, concluding that the science is giving an invalid conclusion, you could accept what it's saying. And what it's saying is that the universe is nothing.
Yeah, I love that way of putting it.
I just thought that was so uncanny. So, okay, we just did speed of light. And what we just showed mathematically, without doing the math, that in some basic way, the universe doesn't exist from light's point of view.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. Which is, again, this is hard to get your mind around, but that's a fact. And now the question is it a valid fact or is basically a nonsense fact? We're saying it's valid. And then you can basically apply that same mental framework to everything else on your list. And I was curious, some of these things take some serious physics to explain how they don't exist. And I was wondering, I had a couple ideas, but I was wondering which one you thought would be a good next one, matter or...
I think particles is my favorite, personally.
Okay, particles, great.
But it's not simple, yeah. I love the example of particles just because it's the thing that seems so obviously real. Because you're talking about literally the table in front of you, your cup, you, everything. Everything that we deal with in our daily lives is made of particles. And we think of those as being these indestructible little things. And that's as solid as it gets. My favorite example, this comes out of Stephen Hawking's work. So Stephen Hawking showed that, okay, a black hole, which is this region of space where gravity is so strong or the curvature of space is so warped that there's a place called the event horizon where the strength of gravity exactly counteracts the speed of light. And so even the speed of light, which is the fastest thing there is, can't escape gravity at the event horizon. And so you have this region that from the outside is completely black, completely dark, because light can't get out. And so that's a black hole. And what Stephen Hawking realized in the 70s, and this was a huge deal at the time because it went against everything people understood about physics, was that actually at the horizon of a black hole, you get these particles called Hawking radiation. So this is the big thing that Hawking is famous for. This is, I love telling people this because I feel like Stephen Hawking is the most famous physicist since Einstein, and yet most people have no idea what he did. But this is what he did. He realized that at the horizon of a black hole, you get these particles. So the horizon is radiating these particles. And there's a million reasons why this was very unexpected. Shouldn't really have a temperature. It should be completely dark. And anyway, so this is a consequence of quantum mechanics and general relativity all coming together at this place. But here's the thing about these particles is if you're an observer outside the black hole, you will measure these hot particles radiating off this horizon. And if you throw something into the black hole, so you take a book, you stay a safe distance away, you throw the book at the black hole, you're going to see it burn up before it crosses the horizon, because it's going to hit this wall of radiation. It's going to interact with all these particles. It's going to be destroyed. You could then go in and collect the ashes of this book. There's nothing about this that's an optical illusion. This is the fact of the matter for you as an observer outside black holes. These particles are there. You can interact with them. They're hot. But you can have another observer who's the observer that falls into the black hole. So in relativity, these are called the one that stays out, accelerated observer, the one that falls in is an inertial observer for anyone who's nerding out on the other end of this. But so for the observer who falls in, there basically is no horizon. They just sail right in. And this is a consequence of general relativity where nothing weird should happen when you pass the horizon. And because of that, for that observer, there's no way for them to know there's a horizon. So there's no particles. There's no heat. There's nothing. So they don't burn up. So if you think about it this way, it's I throw a book in. Before it ever even crosses, it gets totally burnt and destroyed by these Hawking particles. But if I was the book, from the perspective of the book, I just sail right on through. Nothing happens to me. I'm fine. Totally intact. No heat. Nothing. So from the perspective of observer falling into black hole, there are no Hawking particles. From the perspective of observer outside, there are. So here's just a great example of a situation where a particle, which should just be an invariant thing, is either there or it's not, turns out to be observer dependent. And that might sound like this super exotic situation where, like, okay, well, let's not worry about the particles around black holes. But it turns out that the math that is making all this happen applies everywhere. It's not specific to a black hole. So if I just accelerate through space right now in my living room, if I had a really sensitive thermometer, I could measure these particles that would appear because of the very fact that I'm accelerating. And yet someone sitting on the couch, not moving, those particles don't exist for that person. And so this is a fact for all particles that we think exists, that they don't exist in some very deep way. Sorry, that was long.
No, it's good. It's so challenging to understand these things, even when you're reading deep books about them. But what you show in the book, that you just take the science that is available and apply it systematically, because everybody knows what's true about speed of light. It's on the website of Texas A&M's physics department. Everybody knows what you just said about particles. Well, not everybody, but people in physics know about this. And you can go to each one of these things and find a state where, from a perspective or from an observer's perspective, that state doesn't exist. And so then what you argue is that that's because at bottom, the universe is nothing. It started as nothing, became something, and it's a duality.
Yeah.
And I definitely wanted to ask you, you talk about how nothing is unstable.
Yeah.
And it essentially explodes because of, you say, quantum fluctuations. And I had follow-up questions around that. But maybe if you could talk a little bit about this idea of what a nothing state is, because there's also physicists who define it. They define it as maximal entropy. There's a lot about that state that I struggled to understand.
Yeah, I mean, you're not the only one, for sure. Frank Wilczek, who's a Nobel Prize winning physicist at MIT, he's written a lot about this idea that nothing is unstable, that nothingness is unstable. And there's a few ways to get at that. It's really, really interesting. You were saying it's a state of maximum entropy, which is true. It's also a state of maximum symmetry. And in every other scenario, those two quantities are opposite one another. And nothingness is this one state where they become the same. So it's like a state of no entropy and maximum entropy at the same time. Because entropy describes how likely a given state is. But if you have a state of nothingness where it's perfect sameness, you change one little thing and now it's not nothing anymore. So in that sense, it's very, very low entropy. And then you could say, well, the laws of thermodynamics say that entropy is always going to increase. And so therefore it's going to change. So that's one way. Another way is to say, well, it's perfect symmetry. And in physics, symmetry tends to break. So it's unstable in all these different ways. And quantum mechanics, one of the fundamental laws of quantum mechanics is the uncertainty principle, which says that if you know the location, let's say, of a particle to absolute precision, then its momentum becomes completely uncertain. And so there's a million ways of talking about this, but one consequence of that is that if you zoom in really, really carefully on some particular point in space, which means you're locating its position like super carefully, its momentum is going to start varying wildly. And so you get these huge fluctuations of energy. And so you basically, because of quantum uncertainty, you can never have a state of zero. Everything's zero. Perfect stillness, because that would be a super certain state. And so instead, as you get closer and closer to nothing, you're going to get these crazy fluctuations. And so people talk about if you start with a state of nothing, you can have these quantum fluctuations and that will change it. Or you could have the symmetry and it breaks, or you could have entropy and it increases. So there's all these different ways to say why it's unstable, but it does seem from a typical physics perspective to be a very unstable state. But there's a sense in which I really wanted to go beyond that, because when you're saying that, you're already assuming all the laws of physics are in place. And then you're just taking the state and saying, oh, okay, well, the laws of physics say this is going to happen, this is going to happen. But then where did the laws of physics come from? So I feel like that's already starting too far in. If you want to get it, what is everything really, really at bottom? And so I think in a certain way, we were talking before about how quantum mechanics, how Wheeler saw with delayed choice and everything, that order of time is really screwy in physics. It's this idea that, okay, it starts as nothing, and then you have some fluctuation or something, and then it changes into something. That's a very linear story. And I think in that sense, that story can't be right. So I think the maybe deeper point is, well, it just is nothing. And then something is what nothing looks like from a given perspective.
From the inside.
From the inside, which is the only place you can be.
So that's the part I've been thinking about a lot. But let me go back to full circle about why the quantum. And so where was the universe before the Big Bang? And so you basically are arguing that, and feel free to restate this, that the universe starts at a high energy state, which also happens to be equivalent to a low energy state, absolute zero or absolute infinity. There's a definition of singularity is infinity, but from a different perspective is also zero. And so that's the Big Bang. And so that gets at this question of what happened before the Big Bang and why the quantum is that if you were to know the position and the momentum of anything, if you were able to take any one of the things that you went and often tested and find that it was real from all perspectives, then definitionally it wouldn't be nothing. It would be something. But because it's nothing, the universe, the laws of physics essentially prevent you from making it invariant.
Yeah.
The nature of it itself, the fundamental nature of it is that it's nothing and something, but as a result, you can't measure it from all perspectives to prove that it's something, because it isn't something, it's nothing.
Yeah. You're blowing my mind and I should know this stuff. Yeah, it's hard to think about.
The consequences of that, I don't understand, but it's probably not that different than how people felt in 1905 when Einstein said time and space are not real. You basically eventually discover that nothing is.
Yeah.
And then you need a bunch of scientists and philosophers to figure out, well, that to understand what that might mean, because it doesn't, again, it's not concomitant with our understanding of the universe.
Yeah.
It's an experience. Our experience is not nothing.
Well, so you were saying why the quantum, and it's, okay, if you start from the normal everyday assumption that things are invariant, they are real, we all agree on things, all of that. Then quantum mechanics seems completely inexplicable and bizarre. Part of what I was trying to say in the book is, let's say you don't start with that assumption. Let's say you start with the assumption that everything's nothing. What would you expect to happen when you start looking at things in this way? And so you would have to say, well, there can't be a fact of the matter. There can't be a fact of the matter about where the electron was. There can't be a fact of the matter about which path this light took from 10 billion light years away. A lot of the seeming mysteries about quantum mechanics, it's not that they become less mysterious, but they become inevitable in a certain way where, okay, there is no God's eye view, or if you could take the God's eye view, you would see the nothing. So that's the ultimate point of the book, is one way of talking would be to say you can't have a God's eye view. Another way would be to say if you did have a God's eye view, you would see nothingness. And it's precisely because we can't have a God's eye view that we see something. So the universe appears to be something because we're always in a limited frame of reference. But if you could get out of that somehow, you would see that it's all really nothing. And so if you say, well, why does it look like something? Well, because we're stuck inside of it and we have a limited frame. And so therefore, you have no access to this infinite, unbounded state because you're always bounded and finite. And so why the quantum? Well, maybe one way of talking about it is to say, because everything's nothing. And if everything's nothing, then those are the laws of physics you would actually, to some extent, you would expect.
Exactly. The strange behavior of quantum physics or quantum mechanics actually is not strange at all, because you're trying to do something that wouldn't be possible. So that's spooky action at a distance and all these things that just are, according to our sense of the universe, or what we thought.
Yeah.
Which is that it's this thing Newton had described, and we exist within it as a rock. And that's why I love Wheeler, because he has this obsession with this idea that the observer creates a universe. In some ways, that's such a beautiful idea.
Yeah. And Wheeler expresses everything so beautifully, too. He's just, if anyone listening hasn't read any John Wheeler physics books, I would recommend them. They're poetry. They're amazing.
Yeah, actually, I have a quote from your book, which you quote him. He's going to the hospital, and he wants to have a last word before he leaves this earth.
Yeah, just in case.
Just in case, yeah. And he says, quote, "Something of an information theoretic character is at the bottom of physics, space-time, existence itself."
Beautiful. What's so crazy about the stuff that Wheeler did is he's thinking so philosophically and so poetically, and it's so abstract in a certain sense. And then at the same time, that idea that everything has this information theoretic character, he was coming at that from the super philosophical perspective, but then that created this entire field of physics called quantum information, just based on how he was thinking about this stuff, which led to quantum computers that has massive practical implications. And I'm always interested in this in general. It's just fascinating. You're talking about these things that seem so what's nothing, what's something. It seems like it shouldn't have any practical implications at all. And then it turns out it really does in these wild ways. So that statement alone, he had this slogan like "it from bit," which was meant to capture this information theoretic thing. And that's quantum computers. I mean, that came out of that.
Let me just ask you one more thing, because I just find this so mind-blowing. So vacuum energy and negative pressure.
Yeah, yeah.
Because what's happening is that the universe is expanding at an accelerated rate. And there's so many interesting things about that. But one of those things that's interesting is that that prevents there from ever being a single universe, because over time, as space expands, parts of the universe, galaxies that we see today, will disappear. They're moving away faster than the speed of light eventually. And then they'll be gone. And then once light can't touch them, from our universe's point of view, they don't exist.
Yeah.
I wondered, but if it's in our history books, if we have pictures of it, What does that mean?
Well, there's all kinds of really interesting questions about this. So if you have the classical idea of, okay, there's just this one big universe out there. To be clear for people, from the perspective of those galaxies, they don't think they're moving away faster than the speed of light. It's just that from our perspective, they're moving faster than the speed of light. But wait, relativity says you can't move faster than the speed of light. But it's the same as if you were on that galaxy and look back at our Milky Way, we would look like we're moving faster than the speed of light too. It's because the space itself is expanding faster than the speed of light, not because the things are moving through space faster. So anyways, if you had this classic idea of how things work, you would say, all right, well, there's a certain point where these galaxies are going to cross out of our event horizon and they're going to disappear to the other side and then we can't access them anymore, but they're still there. They're still just really far away. We just can't see them. Okay, but what all this stuff that we're talking about is telling us is actually, you can't even say that because that would require you to take this God's eye view where you're looking at the universe beyond our horizon. And the crazy thing that I found, and this is not my idea, this is coming from physics, is that, and this is really, really cutting edge stuff in physics, is that you can't talk about things on multiple sides of a horizon at the same time. It's for the same reason that we were saying, if I describe the book that I'm throwing into the black hole, from one perspective, it looks like it's burning up in all this Hawking radiation. From the other, it looks like it's just falling through and it's totally intact and it's fine. If you try to tell both of those stories simultaneously, you end up with these really weird contradictions. The book is both burned up and it's not burned up, which of course sounds a lot like quantum mechanics. But you end up, there's laws of physics that get violated when you do that. And so it prevents you from being able to do that at all. So then if once it crosses out of a horizon, it literally doesn't exist anymore. But there might be an analog of this Hawking radiation at the horizon of our universe. And so you might be able to say something like, well, the galaxy has all become Hawking radiation at the edge of the universe or something. So there might be a way to recollect that information. But yeah, I mean, the really crazy thing, just thinking about it in everyday terms, is if you live long enough, if our sun lived long enough, the sky would be dark. There'd be no stars eventually. It's all going to expand away because of this dark energies.
I don't think we ever say this in the book, but when you extrapolate the idea, essentially, the end state of the universe is a state of perfect nothingness. And where I think my instinct, I think most people's instinct was that the cosmological constant or the inflation of the universe was actually, it was going to contract again. The Big Bang would basically, everything would shrink down to singularity and then blow back up and shrink down and blow back up. But instead it does that in sort of a different loop. It expands out to nothing. And then at that point, the singularity sort of restarts.
Yeah, it's weird. In a certain way, it's the same thing, but it's very different from how people pictured it. People used to ask questions. Hawking really grappled with the idea of everything expands and then it contracts again, just the arrow of time reverse and everything. You see the universe in rewind. And yeah, now it's more like, okay, no, everything's just going to kind of dilute to nothingness until you get some kind of quantum fluctuations or something that start the whole thing again.
So to wind this up, I had two questions, one practical and one very metaphysical. So the first was basically, since you've published the book, what science or discoveries have there been that's either challenged or further confirmed your thesis?
So there's been nothing, amazingly nothing that I can think of that's really changed any of the conclusions. And yeah, if anything, maybe just confirmed it a little more in pieces. I mean, there's conceptual things that I still struggle with that come back to this question of what's the observer? That's really what I've been thinking about ever since. Because that was something I still felt was kind of unresolved at the end of the book. Or at least in my own thinking, it was. Yeah, that's the big philosophical question I'm still thinking about. But in terms of the physics itself, it's all where the book leaves it in a way.
Okay, I'm going to take a giant leap here. It's taking a risk here. But to me, there seems to be two big questions. And that one is, where did the universe come from? And the other one is, where did life come from?
Yeah.
And both seem to come from nothing in a way. The material properties don't obviously become sentient life.
Yeah.
Sometimes I think about your book and I think in the same way that nothing can become something, it's an emergent property of nothing. This concept of an observer is not inherently tied to life. You're saying it's mathematically inherently tied to any frame of reference. A listening device can be an observer, but it does feel somehow connected. And I know Wheeler was obsessed with this. The idea that you can create a universe from nothing then makes me feel like, well, then of course you would create life from nothing in the same ontology.
Okay, so this is me being speculative too. But I do think there's something to the connection between life and the universe in that way. And I'll tell you why. Because so the thing that I learned at bottom in some way is that as an observer, to create a universe from nothing, you have to draw a boundary. Because the whole idea is that the nothingness is a boundless state. And as soon as you have a boundary, it's not nothing anymore. So that's how you go.
Yeah, mathematically.
That's how you go from nothing to something. So you could say the fundamental act of observation is drawing a boundary. And that could be the boundary between you, the observer, and the thing you're observing. That's enough to give you both the observer and the observed. That boundary comes into existence. And when you look at what life is, and there's a whole philosophy of biology that comes from people like Francisco Varela and Umberto Maturana, and this whole theory called autopoiesis. This is really cool stuff I've been nerding out of lately. But the whole idea is that the definition of life, to some extent, is a thing that creates its own boundary. The smallest unit of life is a cell, and the whole, what makes a cell, what makes it alive, is that it is a network of processes that creates its own membrane that separates it from the environment. So if the membrane doesn't exist, the cell just bleeds back into the world. It doesn't exist as a thing. But unlike a rock or something, a cell makes its own boundary and remakes it over and over and over as entropy tries to take it away. This is the fundamental act of being alive, is to draw a boundary that makes you a thing. And it's a leap because these are obviously very different types of boundaries, but there's something to me that really sparks my imagination in that idea. And then I think when you get into certain aspects of cognitive science, it's the fundamental cognitive act, what it means to think, is the same as what it means to be alive. It's to draw these boundaries. It's to draw distinctions in the world and to say, this is me, this is not me. And it's not a trivial thing to do. And so I do think there's some really interesting link there. Inanimate matter doesn't draw its own boundary. I draw a boundary that I call a rock because I see it and I say, oh, that's a thing, and it's different from everything else. But the rock doesn't think it's a thing.
Yeah, even thinking is a self-referential process. Your thought with no universe. So this is why I want to get your idea out there so we can move on to this next leap, which we're not there yet. I wanted to have you on the show for exactly this reason and also for this conversation. So it's I'm so appreciative. I mean, I just think you're brilliant.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm just appreciative that you read the book and want to talk about it.
Yeah, I wish I could have gone through every one of your tests and analyses because each one are so deep. And really, we can't do it justice on the show to really get into how each one of these things is not real or not invariant. But it's a wonderful thing you think you did for moving knowledge a little bit forward. And so that's why I call the show Onward.
Yeah, exactly.
Mandy Gefter, thank you for coming on Onward.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been fun.
Thanks so much for joining me. You've been listening to Onward, the Funrise podcast, featuring Amanda Gefter, the author of Trespassing on Einstein's Lawn, which, if you want to understand and get to the bottom of all this, I highly recommend. My name is Ben Miller, CEO of Funrise. I invite you again to please send your comments and questions to onward@funrise.com. And if you like what you've heard, rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. And be sure to follow us wherever you listen to podcasts. For more information on Fundrise-sponsored investment products, including relevant legal disclaimers, check out our show notes. And I want to dedicate this episode in memory of John H., who inspired it, and so much more. We'll miss you forever. I'll see you next episode.